I was just going to say, we talk about civic literacy, and I think that that's so important, that we understand the system, that we understand how it works. And I also think, too, though, that politicians of all parties need to take some responsibility. I think in the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a real move towards negative politics, mm-hmm. a real move to isolate, to look towards key voting people. You know, the fact that a prime minister can be elected with less than 40% of the vote says to me that, you know, what's the reason that inspires them to go out and to get 80 or 90% of the people coming out, because that will change the result that they're going to see. So, you know, what are the factors that are driving this? And I think, you know, politicians have to take a responsibility. Voters have to take a responsibility. Mm-hmm. The media in particular, my brethren in the media need to take responsibility for the kinds of things that we do. I mean, it's all so important, because each of these aspects contributes to voter engagement.
Well, one of the things that I remember, and again, I got a long political memory, but, you know, when I was in high school, and there were a number of kids in my high school who were of voting age, and Ian Scott was the Attorney General of Ontario at the time. They were running for re-election. But Jean Chrétien had just become leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. And I remember him coming to my high school. And I don't remember hearing, you know, I think occasionally you might hear now at a public engagement where the prime minister might be there and there'll be a bunch of kids. There was a Twitter photograph going around a few days ago about him speaking with a bunch of kids behind him. But you don't hear about the prime minister of the country or the leader of the opposition or even the leader of the third party. Well, wait a second. Justin Trudeau does that. Justin, the Liberals still do this thing where they try and reach out and engage with voters. And they were doing that while they were in power. So I think part of the problem, too, is this shift in the way political parties have traditionally engaged people, and maybe some of the parties aren't engaging people in that way anymore.
Well, one of the challenges becomes, I think, to Rob's point, is how you open yourself up as political parties and the process, because it is in a world of technology where things are instantaneous, whether it be Twitter or Instagram or your recordings, where you can take out three words out of the context of a sentence and blast it out there like that's what was said. Mm-hmm. It makes it dangerous. You're taking a risk as a politician by openly going and having a discussion. I do these coffee parties, various things around the riding. People will invite 20, 25, 30 of their, or sometimes less, 10 of their friends, neighbors, their book club, of all political stripes. And I sit down, I say, this is a conversation. You know, I'll tell you why I'm doing this, why I believe in what I'm doing, what I want to see, and then I want to hear from you. I want you to ask me the questions you want to ask, and I will answer them. And it's a risk to do that as a politician, because you're always at risk. I could say to you, Dave, 20 years ago, if you were doing an interview with me, and I you could ask me a question, and I'd give you an answer, and then I'd say, well, wait a second, that sort of came out wrong. That's not exactly what I meant. Here's sort of the frame I put it in. You can't do that anymore. There's no do-overs, if you will. And so that makes it a risk. And for that reason, you're right. Justin has been going out and continues to do, as do I, and I would argue our party as candidates. But you are taking a risk. I think the risk is worth it, because I think you engage people by opening yourself up, by having that conversation. Nobody wants to listen to sound bites and talking points.
Well, and to your point, I mean, we saw the interview with Stéphane Dion that was done on the East Coast, where they showed the outtakes, where, you know, because of the breakdown in communication between English and French, he didn't quite understand how the question was being put to him, or didn't understand what the question was. Ultimately, he did. And when they ran the original version of it, the edited version, if you will, on the news, it was a conversation. But what ended up happening was the edited parts, the parts where he was having difficulty, the part that, you know, under any other time probably never would have made it to the airwaves, but he was running for prime minister at the time, so the leader of the government of the day, and so there, let's use it, that's fair game, right, to take a guy completely out of context who's maybe, I mean, I don't do that here, that's ambush, you know, I don't ambush people on this show, and I think we have a responsibility as media to ask responsible questions. You know, I was watching Obama being interviewed today with regards to the Iran deal, just to get to a case in point. And he was asked a question about, you know, how he obviously felt some joy about the fact that there were still Americans being held in Iran, some of them illegally. There's four people there. One's a former CIA agent that the Iranian government is saying they don't know anything about, and two are Americans who are incarcerated. And the question being put to him by a CBS journalist was, you know, how can you be so happy about these hostages that are still being held in Iran when you celebrate this Iranian deal? And the president looked at him and said, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. That's a ridiculous question. But, you know, as you said, when you are in an open forum like that, you're going to get ridiculous questions. So you've got to know how you're going to respond to those questions. And that's often the hard part. I mean, I know that right now there are a lot of people out there that are getting sort of the missed messages because the commercials that are on TV right now talking about various programs. I mean, today the National Post said the nastiest political ad out there right now is the NDP ad, where they talk about, you know, Michael Sona having been jailed. And it finishes off with Dean Del Mastro being led out of the courthouse in chains. And they're saying that's the nastiest commercial out there. And it's an NDP ad. And, oh, the NDP are playing nasty. But all the NDP are doing is putting up the names and faces of people with the Conservative Party of Canada who've been found guilty of offenses. Whether it's election fraud, whether it's the robocalls, whether it's in and out, whatever it was, these are all people, 13 people. There are 13 senators currently under potential indictment with the RCMP. All those people are being named in this ad. That apparently is a nasty ad. But to run another ad from the conservative perspective, which makes stuff up, which quite frankly lies about a position of the opposition party, that's apparently not nasty.
I think one of the things that is also important here is to recognize the synergy between news media and politics. And I know from the work that I did on the Online Democracy Project at Loyalist College, we worked very hard to treat media as facilitators between the public and the politicians. And rather than necessarily taking a particular stand or an ideology, just simply creating tools using emerging and new technologies to get conversations going. And it was incredibly challenging. And one of the things that I took away from that was a very strong sense of the need for an ongoing conversation. We have the technology now that there should be a constant conversation going between politicians and citizens. There's no reason for that not to be the case. But what has happened instead has been a deliberate effort by public relations firms, by political managers, to shut down the conversation, to limit access to information, and more and more and more to try and control messages rather than having this flowing conversation. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that I think becomes problematic, because I think there are two things that can happen more often. One is that news media can leverage all these fabulous tools that we have so that there is a constant conversation going on, that there are tools like Scribble Live, like Twitter, like Facebook, where things can be put out there and politicians should be responding. I'm floored to think that on a local level that the mayor is not tweeting every day, that council members are not putting stuff up on Facebook and saying, hey, guess what? We're thinking of adding umpteen slips to the harbor. What do you think? And getting those discussions going. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, on the other side of it, is we see politicians who don't want to speak to the media. I've just spent the last 2 weeks working in the local newsrooms, and I can tell you, it is bloody hard to get a hold of somebody to phone you back to say, here's what you want to talk about. And the moment they want to talk to you, it's got to be a controlled situation. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, is you watch a prime minister who runs as fast as he can away from the media because he doesn't want to answer any spontaneous questions that he might find himself in a position where he's not prepared to answer. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think that access to information laws have become so restrictive that the news media, it takes them years to get a hold of basic documents, basic information that citizens have paid for that we should be able to get our hands on, mm-hmm. so that governments can be accountable. I mean, those are you know, when we talk about engagement, if it was a machine, this is the grease that makes the wheels turn mm-hmm. inside that machine. And I think we're missing out.
Well, and I think you're right. Because we have so many of those problems, as you've just outlined, it does lead to people saying, well, what the hell's the point? They're all the same. Why should I engage? Oh, I don't vote, and I'm absolutely proud of it, because why would I want to engage in this type of activity? So it does sort of throw a bit of mud over the entire process, and it's a lot of digging that folks have to go there. And like Warren Kinsella said, you know, when he was with the executive at Jean Chrétien, they used to look at documents and they'd say, well, is this something that's going to affect national security? And the person would say no. He goes, okay, off to the Library of Parliament with it then. You know, it could be something embarrassing to the government. Well, you know, the government will get over it. It's owned by the public. I mean, and even Warren Kinsella said, look, the reality is, unless it's something that's truly a matter of national security, you know, you're talking about bomb codes or something, it really should be public information. It should just go right into the Library of Parliament. It does in the U.S. Heck, it's easier to get documents through the Library of Congress than it is through the Parliamentary Library.
Well, and we certainly said, Justin Trudeau made one of his policy statements, is that, in fact, it has to be more accessible. And the fee that average citizens have to pay to access information is ridiculous. The fact that information requests are taking 2 and 3 years. In fact, a colleague of mine had an information request in, I think it was for 2 years. It might have been a bit more. Finally got a letter back saying, oh, well, this is too old to respond to now, so we're not going to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the appeal to not, you know, just ignore it and it will go away.
Yeah.
The problem is, it's similar to me, when Mr. Harper got rid of the long-form census, he took away so much of our ability to plan, to be able to look toward what we're going to need next, what our country is going to look like. That was the basis lots of decisions were made, whether it was mm-hmm. be healthcare or education or housing, all sorts of things. It's the Freedom of Information requests are similar to that. People are asking for them because they have a need to get information to inform something, whether it be a decision, whether it be a process. And the fact that they don't get them puts us, in my opinion, further and further back in mm-hmm. the line in terms of being an advancing country.
I also think it undermines basic democracy.
That too.
Because you can't, how are you supposed to vote? How are you supposed to hold governments accountable if you can't get proper information to mm-hmm. determine these things? And I think that this is where, you know, we start to walk a fine line and people get discouraged. I mean, why should they care if they feel that they're being oppressed by the fact that they can't be heard, the governments don't respond to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a critical piece.
Well, and the other part about the census that drives me crazy is this is where you get information on child development, on how many children are in the country. I mean, some of that comes out on the basic form, but you don't, you know, you need to know backgrounds for people when you're providing services. You need to understand if housing really is an issue, you need to be able to have the numbers to back that up. Without those numbers, the government can say we don't have a national housing tragedy or crisis, or we don't have a national health care crisis, because they don't have the supporting document that would come through information through a long form census, which, as you pointed out, Kim, Justin Trudeau has already said he's going to reinstate that. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more of Consider This Live here on Northumberland 89.7. We'll be right back.
Hey, all you fat cats, you just got to be cool, mama. Be here and I'll keep you tight and out of sight on Uncle Charlie's Cosmic Circus. Wednesday nights, 9 to midnight, where I'm going to shake the tree from the roots and rake up the fruits. Rip it up out of the ground and find out what's going down. Wednesdays, 9 to midnight with me, Uncle Charlie. Don't miss it. You don't want to be no jive turkey now, do ya? Ooh, I nailed that one.
You've gone and done it again. You agreed to plan your company's dinner party. Where will you hold it this year? Of course, there's nowhere better to hold large events than at the Legion Hall in Colborne. Hold your receptions and private parties at the Legion Hall, and you can get them catered. Call Shelley at 905-372-6554 and book the Legion for your event today. And call Sue at 905-342-2087 for catering.
The Royal Canadian Legion Branch 133 is located at 136 Orr Street in Cobourg. Call 905-372-2231 and become a member today.
Hometown Bingo is your community connection for fun and excitement 7 days a week.
Christmas in July, Saturday, July 25th. At the 7 p.m. session, there are over $5,000 in cash prizes to be won. Jackpot game $1,000, second chance jackpot $1,000. Also, if you bingo and I-25 is on your winning card, you'll receive 25 bingo bucks.
Hometown Bingo in Colburn, 884 Division Street, just south of Elgin, on the east side. Check out their website at hometownbingo.ca.
Jim McGrath understands that as much as we don't want to talk about it, wills and estate planning is a responsible thing to do for you and your family. With his help, you can reflect on your values and wishes and have a legal direction to let others know what kind of health and personal care you would want if you could not speak for yourself. Jim McGrath has been a lawyer for over 30 years, and he understands the law, so you don't have to. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones to call Jim McGrath today at 905-373-1999.
We're all volunteers here at Northumberland 89.7. Interested in getting involved? We have positions on air and behind the scenes. Send us an email, info@northumberland897.ca.
And welcome back to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio. If you'd like to contact us, please feel free, 905-372-2321 or 905-372-2391. You can also send me a tweet on Twitter at Lagant66 or send something to the station at info@northumberland897.ca. Hey, and if you do Facebook, you can follow us on Facebook too, Facebook.com/Northumberland897. Joining me in the studio is our good friend Rob Washburn for Consider This Live. And a pop-in guest this afternoon is Kim Rudd. Welcome back to the show, Kim. We've been talking about political engagement. One of the things, one of the impediments, I guess, we've been talking about for the last while is this sort of government. And I mean, let's face it, the previous government did it as well, where after a certain amount of time in power, you know, you get this idea that, well, you must be doing something right because we're still in power. And so I guess what we're doing is good and we'll just continue doing that. But when you don't engage the public, as this government hasn't done, I mean, I got to say, for straight up, okay, I wasn't a strong fan of Mr. Kretchan's government, okay? And if this show was on during then, you listeners would know that. But I think part of the problem, the legacy, if you will, of what the Liberals did was that just like what happened in Ontario with Bob Rae, they showed the Conservatives just how far you can push Canadians before they actually say, ouch, it's hurting. And by the time it starts to hurt, oftentimes it's too late. We found that out in Ontario under Mike Harris. We're still, in my opinion, digging ourselves out from that hole. And this is why we're in this financial chasm we are. And a lot of people would say, oh, the Liberals have been in power for 10 years. Yeah, well, as you said during the break, it's going to take us 20 years to gather the information we've lost over the last decade on the census. So part of the problem, I think, with the disengagement is it's by design. I think, personally, I believe that it has been a concerted effort on the part of the ruling government to try and disengage as many people as possible.
Well, then let's ask him this, because a lot of problems are out there. And they're enormous. Climate change. I mean, even in our own community, we look at the local economy. We say, oh, we've got to fix this. We've got to fix that. We try to throw Band-Aids on wounds that need stitches. There's precarious employment. There's so much that goes on. It's so complex. As a politician, what do you say back to us that isn't going to sound like just a lot of mumbo jumbo?
Well, all that's true. And people are... Because we're knocking on doors, because I'm talking to people and going to events and barbecues and all everywhere I can go to talk to people, what I'm getting from them is, unfortunately, a lot of, to Dave's point, I don't know what I can do about it. I don't know what I can do about it. You know, the interest rates went down today by 0.5%. What happens when they go back up? What happens to families who are barely getting by right now and managing their mortgages? What happens when they go back up? We have a tendency right now in government to look at the short term. Certainly this government is looking at those short term things, to your point, Dave, about appealing to a base of voters, and it doesn't really matter what really happens to the rest or what the rest think, because that's not who they're aiming for. So my response to people is that, as an advocate in this community for almost 40 years, if there is an issue, if there's a problem, the strongest way to address those is with a group of like-minded people who have the ability and capability and desire to find the solution. I don't believe that, You know, there's a book, The Party of One. Mr. Harper's, you know, pretty much a party of one. And I say that we're a team of many. We've got lots of bench strength. We've got lots of people in the fray, if you will, that are working to find the solutions. And I always think when you get a lot of people around a table working on a problem, you'll come up with solutions. So in terms of jobs, to your point, closer to the election, I'm actually producing a platform for this riding specifically. We have three PhD researchers and a job specialist, and we've been interviewing around the riding, both employers, employment specialists, a variety of people. And we will have a platform specifically for this riding. Why? Because someone recently said to me that the biggest security threat to Canadians is not having a job. Because if they don't have a job or don't have income, their housing is precarious. Their health is precarious. All those, education, all of those things down the line. So you have to start somewhere. Jobs, to me, for this riding particularly, are the priority. Yes, the environment, huge issue. There are people in the current government and others, trust me, I talk to them, who think climate change is not real. It is just something that's cooked up by someone. Well, you go talk to the people in Saskatchewan and British Columbia, et cetera, with the fires. You talk to the people who've had, you know, parts of our countries that have floods. You talk to the apple orchards locally who lost their crop because of the frost we had. Those are examples of climate change, and there are many other. So environment, obviously a huge issue. Our healthcare system, as you know, the people talk to me about it. Yes, it's a provincial issue in terms of delivery, but federal government has a huge role to play in terms of financing. The accord expired 2 years ago. Mr. Harper extended it for 2 years. It mm-hmm. expires next year, and he extended it at a 50% escalator. So it's only going up 3%, not 6. So I am concerned, and I tell people this, that if Mr. Harper gets back into government, he's not a federalist prime minister. You know, we are a country. We're a federation. We have a responsibility to work with the provinces to find solutions that work for them. And the strength of our healthcare system is the framework and the structure. So remember years ago when Ontario tried to privatize a few things mm-hmm. and the government of the time said, oh, wait a second, you do that, we're pulling back mm-hmm. the strings. Those are the kinds of sort of bold moves, I guess, in terms of the environment, creating a framework similar to the healthcare framework that says every province, yes, we'll negotiate what those rules, if you were, or plans for reducing greenhouse gases and other things are, and we'll support you to do that. But understand, if you don't do it, then there will be strings. Those are the kinds of they don't get votes. Because they're nuanced, they're a bit complicated. People don't understand them because often they're more than, you know, you can't explain the environmental issues in a soundbite. But they're important, and we're willing to take the risks as a party of doing things that go beyond the next election cycle and putting things out there that are going to look 5, 10, and 15 years down the road. Mm-hmm. You look at our healthcare system, you look at our rail system that came about that way, our pension system. Those weren't things that were written on the back of a napkin hoping to get to the next election. So I tell people there's a vision, there's hope, and I hate to use, you know, sort of sound like a soundbite, but there's a heck of a lot of hard work that has to be done to get there. But mm-hmm. I have a track record. I've demonstrated I can get it done, and I intend to do it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've talked about on this show a million times is the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform. Mm. This is a group that wants to get the Bank of Canada back into financing this government. And the argument from right-wingers and from most, if you will, economists, is that if the Bank of Canada, our central bank, gets into doing that financing, that it's going to create a serious amount of inflation. You can't have zero interest debt out there. Well, I would argue right now we're at 0.5%. We're pretty much at zero. All right? We know that when we bailed out the banks, I mean, the Americans spent 10 times what we did, but we spent in the area of $350 billion bailing out the banks. We gave them interest-free funding. So why is it not inflationary when we give inflation-free funding to bankers And yet it would definitely cause inflation if we said, screw the bankers, we're just going to borrow the money from our own bank. You know, we own the bank. I know this isn't something that is a political platform, but at this stage of the game, with interest rates being at 0 or 0.5%, it does beg the question, you know, is there some movement within the party, and maybe not just this party, but other in government itself, to go back to that? Because you talked about the Canada Pension Plan. You talked about the highways that we built. You talked about the major infrastructure projects, the fact that the federal government paid 50 cents on the dollar for universality of health care. All of that was paid for through the Bank of Canada when we were accessing the bank directly.
But I think that's a really technical issue, and I appreciate that it's critical in the big picture. And when, you know, you want to sit around in the Algonquin room and we'll have a big debate, that makes sense. But I think when you look at downtown in every village and town across this county, and you see empty storefronts, and literally they're giving away stores because they want to encourage entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. The town's ready to sink itself into $10 million worth of debt to fix up the facades. You've got people that can only work 12 to 20 hours a week because there isn't an employer who's prepared to give them proper 40 hours, to give them benefits, to make sure that people are being looked after. And then you wonder why, you know, FAO Schwartz just announced today it's closing. Well, nobody's got money to buy stuff. Businesses are shutting down because no one's got any money. People can't afford housing because they don't have money. I mean, these are the fundamental issues when people go home and sit down in front of their hot dog and their beans, that are they realize, oh my God, what's going to happen to me?
Well, we've created a false economy, in my opinion. If I hear one more time that the government has created 1.2 million net new jobs,
since 2009,
I want to scream. Which there have been more people than that enter the workforce. So it's a false number. But to your point about the stores in downtown, when I often say to people, this false economy that's been created doesn't have any disposable income. When people are making $12 an hour, they are, we hope, getting by, but often not. It's causing, and we can talk about seniors in a minute, because some of the stories I'm getting from seniors knocking on door, it will just make your heart bleed.
It's not just seniors.
People don't have extra money to go and eat down to, you know, at a restaurant, or buy a TV, or buy a new car. They're still fixing the one they have and hope it will go. Keep going. The only way you can grow the economy from a job perspective is to be creating jobs that have a living wage. Think of when we lost Kraft. Think of when we lost Strapax, and we've lost Viceroy, and we've lost all of those things. And I think we're becoming fairly complacent about it, and that's very sad to me that it's not so much as a blip on the screen often anymore. Well, we've lost some more jobs. The way our downtown businesses do well is if people have money to spend in them. Until they do, you can bring an entrepreneur in to create a business and open a store. But who's going to be there? We need to create jobs so people have disposable income. At the end of the day, it addresses so many of the other issues if people have that.
Well, but to my point, which was infrastructure spending, I mean, if the government can borrow from the Bank of Canada at zero interest, it doesn't increase the national debt. It's money that can be paid back to the Bank of Canada over, I believe it's a year. So you focus on infrastructure projects. Those are projects that pay good money. People who work in those big projects make good money. That puts people back to work. I mean, it worked with the New Deal in the United States. And I hate to go back to the 1930s, the last Great Depression. But let's face it, listeners, you know, the jobs have disappeared. You know, this, as you pointed out earlier, this is the first time since the 1940s that Canada is in a recession and our neighbors to the south are. The American economy is growing. They're just not buying from us, and they're not buying from us because we've hollowed out whole segments of this province. So, for instance, if we were to spend the $4.5 billion needed right now at the federal level to promote the Ring of Fire, we could definitely get people to work up there. That's jobs. That's real growth. That's money.
But just think, just go to any municipal leader across this country, and they'll tell you how many roads need to be fixed, how many sewers need to be replaced, how many sidewalks need to be done. I mean, there's no shortage of projects. It's just who's going to be prepared to spend the money.
The federal government has to be prepared to spend the money. Now, we do have a caller online, and we're going to go to that caller just right now. Go ahead. You're on the line.
Hello. Sorry, it's me again.
Don't apologize for listening, Ed. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Ed. Good to hear from you.
Thanks for calling back, Ed. I was kind of jealous when you phoned the hour before me.
Okay, well, my big thing is now I hear you guys talking.
That's good.
I'm now a senior, okay? What are you going to do for me tomorrow? Not 5 years down the road, because a lot of the people I talk to go, hey, I'm not going to be around anyway.
So. Well, the first thing they're not going to do is get rid of income splitting for seniors.
Yes.
Well... My big thing is you look around and you see people that just absolutely cannot exist on the way prices are, and they can't exist on what's going on. We can't put them, you know, we can put me, whatever, in a home because that costs too much. When is a policy going to come through for keeping people in their homes, helping them out with property taxes, helping them out with, you know, I mean, it to me it seems cheaper to have... home care people come around than it is to have somebody in a hospital bed. You know, we got all kinds of things, and I mean, my kids have kids, so you know, I'm thankful that you know they're getting a little bit of assistance. But where's the help for the seniors?
Well, Ed, very good question, and I'll answer it in a couple of parts. One is stay tuned for our platform, the Liberal platform on seniors that will be out in the next week's number of weeks to come. So stay tuned for that because it certainly will give you more detail. But I will say a couple of things. One, certainly today's point, we keep hearing from some of the negative ads are out there. There's a suggestion that the Liberal Party would do away with income splitting for seniors. I just want to make it really clear that Justin Trudeau and our party have said clearly we think that is good policy and we will be keeping income splitting for seniors. So I just want to put that out there. The other thing that there's lots of, to your point about home care, I absolutely agree with you. And while provincial governments do deliver that service through their local partners, it does make lots of sense. When I'm knocking on doors, I'm hearing of people who have mortgaged their house because they didn't expect to live as long as they are, and they mortgaged their house in order to sort of have the equity to be able to pay their bills, and they're coming to the end of that equity. And so they're struggling with what to do, absolutely no question. What's the answer? Well, I think there are a number of things that we can do. One is I am, and it's not necessarily to benefit you tomorrow, Ed, unfortunately, because you're already sort of partaking of some of that. But certainly the increase in Canada pension contributions, I think, will be very important helping secure the future for the generations to come to have a livable pension income.
Are you going to roll back the pension from 67 back to 65?
Absolutely. We have made that commitment. I think it's ridiculous that it was changed. I talk to people who do lots of physical labor, whether it be nurses or bricklayers or people that do, and they're saying, you know, we can barely hang on as it is.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly rolling it back to 65. But one of the things that's being discussed, Ed, and I often say to people, if I don't know the answer, if I'm not, I'll tell you I don't. But what I do know is that there are discussions around a national pharmaceutical program. What that looks like, what sort of parameters are coming out, I don't know. But that's certainly something that would assist seniors. Yes, some of the drugs are paid for, they're not all paid for.
As well as dental. I mean,
dental, absolutely.
It costs so much money for that kind of thing that people are doing without. Mm-hmm. Okay, give me a stronger aspirin, you know.
But I also think seniors are becoming a mini industry within government. I've been doing some research over the last couple of days on a number of stories, and I learned that $25,000 just got given to Port Hope to do what they're calling as an age-friendly plan. And this is, they're going to go out, they're going to talk about housing, they're going to talk about services across the town, and they're going to put together a plan. They're hiring a part-time person to do this. Then when I was doing that research, I found out that the county is applied for $50,000 from the Ontario, $30,000 from the province to do something around senior housing. And, well, there's $50,000, and then I look over at Northumberland Community Care, and by geez, don't, they have every one of these things under their mandate, and we're paying $2.5 million for them to do what they're doing. So when you look at it, it's really interesting. Plus, I just today learned that the Winter Games, the 55-plus Winter Games, are coming to to Coburg in 2017. So, you know, when you think about it, Ed, you guys are getting a lot of attention these days. Senior seems to be the big thing.
But none of it ever comes back down the pipeline.
Well, I think that was the point of your initial question was, you know, we're getting a lot of positive banter, but nothing
great.
Ever
I mean,
really geez, tangible.
If I live to be 150 years old, I'm going to be independently wealthy. But that ain't going to happen.
Well, so, Ed, isn't that why we've always taken such great care of our kids? So when we're old, they'll take good care of us.
Well, let's hope they still like you by then.
But don't you think it's really important, though, that we have communities that are 50% of our population is seniors?
Mm-hmm.
It's placing huge pressures on all of our social services, all of our hospitals, and there has been no effort to diversify the local population. And I think when, you know, you look at services and why they're taxed so badly and why we're struggling so hard and all these hardship cases exist,
well,
one of the things I think we have to start to say to ourselves is, why are we bringing seniors to this community? Why aren't we bringing families? Why aren't we bringing young
people? You need jobs to do that.
We've got an industrial park that's empty. There's, there's nobody there. I mean, the other question I was going to ask was, okay, every day there's a new free trade agreement announced. And all we ever see is, now we got less jobs. Okay, what free trade agreement has produced more jobs for us? I mean, it's wrecking the farming industry.
I think the auto pact was the last time we saw any jobs from a real trade deal.
Basically, I mean, you know, these governments go and they bail out these companies, and 2 years later they're gone. Did they bring the money back? No. When they're bailing these guys out, they're talking about I forget what the thing was, but it was like $50,000 per job that they saved.
In terms of the
bailout, and it didn't work. None of this stuff works. Why don't we start bringing the jobs that are out there back to here?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, free trade deals are a good thing if they have reciprocity. And that's the part that to your point, that some of them don't. The trade deal with Ukraine today was more about showing support for Ukraine in terms of the fight with Putin, for want of a better. It's a very small trade. It's $340 million, and I don't think it's really going to make a huge amount of difference either way, but we're strong. It was a message that was being sent.
Isn't that just sticking your finger in his eye?
It was pretty much. It was a big middle finger to Putin, is what it was.
Nothing to me.
Irrelevant.
To me, it's just, there's some more wasted money.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership certainly is one that everybody is beginning to talk about, and it's on the radar, and we're hearing that the U.S. is going to push us to sign by the end of August. And I was just out at Open Farms last week up at the Medina Farm, the dairy farm. And they're concerned about the loss of supply management. It's something that, in my opinion, the quality standards, you remember the melamine that was in the milk from China and the controls and the standards that they don't have?
Yeah, they're feeding paint to their babies, and now we're importing pork.
Well, our food...
You know, what are they feeding the pigs?
Our food source is very important to us as Canadians. I'm a big believer in the 100-mile diet and local food and keeping control. You know, we've had the listeriosis outbreaks. We've had all of those things that make us question the how protected our food system is. Supply management does a couple of things. One, it gives stability to the market. Can we lose supply management? I think at some point somebody may decide to try and negotiate out of it, but that's not something you do because you have you're backed into a corner to sign a trade deal, so you literally give away the farm.
Well, why are we getting backed into the corner? Why does Canada always have to get backed into the corner?
You should ask Mr. Harper.
you know, why can't we be the one saying, no, you know what, this is the way it's going
to
be?
Well, to be fair, I mean, supply management has been in place for 40 years. It's done really well for us. The farmers, the dairy farmers, the egg farmers, poultry producers, they're all loving it. But when it was introduced 40 years ago under the Liberal regime, don't forget, everyone got mad at Pierre Trudeau, rather, for introducing supply management. This has been something the Conservatives have been wanting to get rid of since the wheat board was developed. I mean, as far as the Conservatives are concerned, you know, it's too much government interference, and they want to allow for those products to be sold here. But like I point out, every time we sign a trade deal, I mean, we signed a trade deal with the Americans. They're 10 times our population. I mean, they have the same amount of salespeople in that country as we have people. And you look at China. China is 100 times our population. So, I mean, yeah, how are we getting a fair deal out of that?
We got people in Canada that are hungry.
Yep.
We do.
Okay. We got people up in Northern Ontario that don't have water. Why don't we take care of these people before we worry about selling our stuff to other countries? Why don't we get our own country in order and then worry about selling stuff? You know, I mean, if we had everybody in Canada well-fed, well-taken care of, everything else, that would create a lot of jobs.
Absolutely, and we can do that.
Well, I think not.
Well, part of the problem has been this shift from corporate taxation to individual taxation. I mean, right now, the majority of the taxes collected by the federal government, this is a recent StatsCan report I read yesterday, the majority of the money being brought to the federal government comes from individual taxpayers. Corporations are paying somewhere in the area 13% of the total tax revenue to the federal government. 13 cents. That's what the corporations are paying. They're the ones who are making the most money. They're the ones who are taking the most out of this country. They're the ones who choose to pay their employees slave wages. And yet, at the same time, they're the ones reaping the benefit.
Is the Liberal Party going to change that?
That's a good question.
You know, are they going to be any different? Would the NDP be any different? They're going to say, oh, well, we can't touch these guys because they'll just close shop and move. Well, hey, guess what?
They already have.
Shop and move anyway.
We can't compete with countries like India and China at $2 an hour, whatever their wage is, and we can't. We have to be smarter. So much of what we lost is our innovation, our research and development. Those dollars have gone. They have been stripped out of the budgets to the point where we're not the leaders. Canada's always been the innovator. We've created things. And you know, people tell me not to mention this, but I'm a big BlackBerry fan, and it was created in Canada. And it has done very well. The U.S. government still uses BlackBerry because it's the most secure system. We have the ability to be the leaders, to be the inventors and the creators. Government doesn't create jobs. Government creates the environment to create jobs. That's what we have to do, and that's what we'll do.
Well, unfortunately, it seems like government sure takes the jobs away when they start giving all our stuff away.
Well, it's not that they take jobs away, as they allow those jobs to disappear. Thanks for your call, Ed.
All right.
Bye, Ed.
So, again, to the point about trade deals, again, I don't have any problem with trade. I'm all about trade, but I think there needs to be fair trade. Forget about free trade. I mean, we've got deals that allow corporations to sue our government if we draft laws for example, environmental protection laws. They're exempt, essentially, under the NAFTA agreement, because if you write a law that forces a company to divert some of their profits to cover these expenses, you're now impugning their ability to earn a profit. Ergo, they will sue you, and they have, and they will continue to do that. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back with the close here of today's show, but stick around.
ExploreNet is proud to offer Northumberland County residents fast, reliable, high-speed internet today. Plus, with brand new LTE service on the way, we will be offering download speeds up to 25 megs and 500 gigs of data. Yep, you heard that right. City speeds and data with plans starting at around $50. ExploreNet offers affordable, high-speed internet that connects you to what matters. Call your local ExploreNet dealer, United TV in Cobourg, to hear more. 905-372-6831.
The ratings are in, and the Sunday morning brunch is a runaway hit, says Rolling Stone magazine. Northumberland Today claims Glenn McLaren is the host with the most. Okay, they didn't say that, but this is true, though. The Sunday morning brunch is simply a great show. No hype needed. With old and new features you've come to love, plus now, news, weather, and sports on the 30s, and a host that simply lights up your day. Join me, Glenn McLaren, 7 to 10 for the somewhat improved Sunday morning brunch. On Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio.
My dentures cause me nothing but pain and discomfort.
I can't eat the foods I like because my dentures feel loose.
My gums are so sore it's distracting.
At Apple Dentures, we believe that having dentures doesn't mean you should stop enjoying life. Whether it's loose dentures, new dentures, or implants, our clients have told us time and again how satisfied they were with their experience and their smile. Visit them in the Peter Street Plaza in Port Hope or online at appledentures.ca. Call today for a free consultation at 905-885-2121.
Apple Dentures. Giving your life more bite.
I just got married, and I wanted to leave my collection of flannel shirts to my new wife, Lucille, in case of an unfortunate hunting accident. But my cousin Bob was a lousy shot, let me tell you. Jim McGrath made it easy to make a will so that my three previous wives could not touch my stuff. He's been lawyering for 30 years, and let me tell you, he knows what he's doing. Plus, he's a real nice guy. Call Jim McGrath today at 905-373-1999 and tell him Cletus sent you.
Well, that's taking care of business. That brings us to the end of the show here. You've been listening to Consider This Live on Northumberland 89.7. I'm Dave Glover. Thanks for tuning into The Drive Time. Thanks, Kim, for being here.
Happy to.
Very much appreciate that. And Rob Washburn, always a pleasure to have you in the studio, sir.
Thanks so much.
Next week, of course, we got Jim Bob Marsden coming in from Alderville First Nations. And Kim Rudd is going to be joining us as well with John McKay. So we're going to have you back again next week. Until that time, listeners, keep your dial tuned right here to Northumberland 89.7. Here is Bachman Turner Overdrive.